challenging this move. So I encourage anybody who, you know, connects to San Jose or has friends over there to alert them, at least get them to call into the, I would imagine it's supervisors over there, and to, you know, voice their opinion on this, because it's, the discussion is alive and well. And I, the other thing I wanted to add is I'd gone into our elections department recently to find out, you know, what machines they were using, who, you know, who had made them.
You.
Well, there'd been a good article, and I, you know, want your listeners to know that Comic News has a good insert section in it. It comes out every 2 weeks, and the Green Press always has good political information, and they had a couple of articles about a month ago, or month and a half, about the issue around election machines. So I'm getting more comfortable with the conversation. So I went into our elections department at Santa Cruz County building at Ocean of Water and talked to one of the gals. And the one good thing, I think they're a very trustworthy department, because I've done initiatives and I've had reason to go in there and watch the process. And I, you know, really feel that the people doing the job are very professional and very conscientious. The issue of, you know, somebody being able to call up through the modem and skew things is very relevant, but they're not going to know anything about it unless we get organized. But the one thing that I did get from talking to her is that there's no pressure in this county at this point to move on to the touch screen because, one, we're smaller, two, it's working. And the other thing
isn't the voting machine down there, isn't that done by computer?
I mean, it is done by computer. It and in terms of the articles I read in the Comic News, mm-hmm. they were talking about specific companies that are known to be, you know, controlled by politicos, and it wasn't any of those machines. But I'm suspicious anyway by nature, because I just, you know, I've been learning too much to make me not suspicious. But I know that it was real interesting to see how, when they did the hand recount of this election in Capitola
mm-hmm.
recently, it was a one vote difference in terms of who won, and so one of the candidates paid for a recount, and it came up the same, and it was a hand recount. So, you know, I felt good about that.
Yeah. Well.
You know, I mean, it got tested.
Well, yeah. And also, I mean, you know, of course, how close the fluoride vote was here,
exactly.
both in Watsonville and Santa Cruz. And I know that there were some pretty heavy pressures within the county government. They wanted fluoride in the water. And of course, the people said otherwise. And I think if it was totally corrupted, we'd be drinking fluoridated water here.
And in Watsonville, too.
So there is some indications that it's not corrupted here. But by golly, you know, if we get these touch screens, there's a danger. And, you know, we need to, if we have friends, as you suggest, over the hill, we need to motivate them, inform them what's going on.
And also, give a call casually to, you know, our elections department, because they are the frontline servants. And as I said, having done a couple of initiatives in this county, I've been consistently impressed with who they are, their willingness to, you know, do what they do without agenda. You know, that they're
straightforward.
I trust them.
Good.
You know, it takes one person with an agenda to skew everything. So, but it you know, they could probably all use a phone call, you know, from voters who just love that they're keeping our elections good and strong and free, and how are we going to keep it that way?
That sounds great. I wanted to ask you about something else, a different topic, if I may.
Sure.
There's an article on Saturday, city licensed pot grower convicted on federal mm-hmm. charges, and Ed Rosenthal.
Right.
And there's a pretty revealing, it said, of course, lots of things in there, but I thought it was just outrageous that the judge forbade the jury from knowing anything about the medical aspect of his case. He was not allowed, his defense was not allowed to say one word about medical use. And The jury foreman, Charles Sackett, said that the jury was following federal law and that we had no legal wiggle room. That's just so disgusting, because, of course, all juries have the right of jury nullification if they think the...
No juries know that, actually, and that's... and then when we try and tell them, we get arrested and sent to jail for daring to speak the truth on the, on the steps and lawns of the courthouse. And, we are definitely being challenged, how to educate one another, and that's where programs like yours are very useful. Anybody listening, turn on a few friends to the program. We finally, have a place to, along with Dr. Stan, to discuss, the deeper, the deeper information about, how we can be responsible. I've got a cough, but I want to give you a website.
Oh, okay. Let me grab my pen. All righty.
I went to an interesting discussion this last Wednesday night. This woman, Catherine Pitts, she was an Undersecretary of Housing in the Bush 1 and Clinton administration, got fired both times because her mission was to bring transparency, which means public access, to what's going on in these departments and how they're serving us and how they're not and what the money situation is. And out of that, she currently has a huge lawsuit against the housing department, the Federal Housing Department, not about her work so much as what she found out and about how they've lost $59 billion.
This
goes back into the 90s when this information started coming out, and I can vaguely remember through all the crises we've gone through that issue coming up about how housing had gotten busted for disappearing so much money, basically payoffs, bribery, whatever, $59 billion, and she has had the audacity to go up against the federal government, and she's winning.
Wow! So
point.
What's that
she's
website?
Winning. And her website is Solari, S-O-L-A-R-I, Solari, Solari.com. And very interesting discussion of money and economics and how we, ultimately, how we can invest our money to really create the world we want to create.
Wow, that's
it was a good discussion. And she's, this gal has paid her dues. She had developed some software that allowed citizens, it gave them a structure and a way to go into the, their city, their county, their state government, get the numbers and know how to understand the numbers of the money coming in and the money going out.
That's great. Well, Theodore, we're up against the end of the program here,
okay.
So thank you very much for calling in.
Well, the truth will set us free, and thank you for making truth welcome on your show.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Good night. This is Tom Clooney. I'll be with you next Monday at 7 o'clock. That last website, please go to it. Thank you.
Michael doing the program again? I'm not sure. I have to talk to Tom. We'll work that out. face of skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesty above the
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Right now, of course, we ask you to hold your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, because we have with us on the line Bill Federer. Hi, Bill. How you doing?
Oh, great, Stan.
Well, tonight we were going to have Bill tell you the story of George Washington Carver. It's certainly one of the most powerful stories you've ever heard. So I'm not going to say much of anything. I'm just going to let you go ahead and tell the story, will you?
Well, it's a very inspiring story of someone that went from absolutely nothing to making a tremendous impact in the world. And it starts off in 1865, right after the Civil War. George Washington Carver was born, and we don't know the exact time of his birth because he was born in slavery. His mother, Mary, was the owned by the Carver farmers, Moses and Susan Carver, and George's father belonged to the next farm over, and he was killed in a log hauling accident before George was born, so he never met his dad. When George was still an infant, he was kidnapped. They had bushwhackers, which roamed the South, sort of like, you know, half vigilante and half, you know, Jesse James was a Confederate soldier, but after the war ended, he kept up the killing and the stealing. And but there were people that roamed around and would raid the farms and try to get any treasure that the farmer may have hidden. So they had hung Moses Carver up by his thumbs on a tree and tried to get him to tell where the treasure was hidden. Well, he didn't have any treasure, and so they took Mary and the little infant George and the sister that we don't know a name of, and they fled. Well, the next day, Moses sent out a friend with his best horse And they caught up with the bushwhackers in northern Arkansas. And they said, well, you know, we want to get them back, and they will trade the horse. And they said, we'll tie the horse to this fence and leave, and we'll bring back the mom and the kids. So they tie the horse to the tree and leave, and when they come back, there's no mom, there's no sister. All there is a little black baby lying in a blanket on the ground, dying of whooping cough. And so they pick up the little baby, and they bring him back to Moses and Susan, and they were a childless couple, so they raised George and his other brother Jim as their own children. And Jim was healthy, so he worked out in the fields with Moses Carver, and George was sickly, so he stayed in the cabin, and Susan would teach him tasks, you know, how to cook and sew and mend and crochet and how to read and all those things that later life proved a source of income for George. And his playtime would be to go in the fields around the house and make a little garden. He'd take little things we'd consider weeds, and he'd transplant them, and learned how to nurture them. He said, many a tear I shed when I'd break the roots of one of my little pets. And he called the little plants his pets, and developed a green thumb. And the other farmers in the neighborhood would sometimes bring plants by for George to doctor back to health, or they'd have George look at some of their, you know, fruit trees or something, and he'd help get them back to health. And just a very, skilled and person. And then one of the stories I want to read is how he became a Christian. And this is the book I wrote. It's called George Washington Carver, His Life and Faith in His Own Words. And it's a collection of the letters that Carver wrote throughout his life. And this is one of the letters he wrote in 1931 to a Miss Isabel Coleman of Greensboro, North Carolina. And he said, I was just a mere boy when converted, hardly 10 years old. There isn't much to the story. God just came into my heart one afternoon while I was alone in the loft of our big barn while I was shelling corn to be carried to the mill to be ground into meal. A dear little white boy, one of our neighbors about my age, came by one Saturday morning, and in talking and playing, he told me he was going to Sunday school tomorrow morning. I was eager to know what a Sunday school was, and he said they sang hymns and prayed. I asked him what prayer was and what they said. I do not remember what he said, only remember that as soon as he left, I climbed into the loft, knelt down by the barrel of corn, and prayed as best I could. I do not remember what I said. I only recall that I felt so good that I prayed several times before I quit. I thought, isn't that precious? You know,
it certainly is.
You know, he says his favorite song is, Must Jesus Bear the Cross Alone and All the World Go Free. And then he would go into Neosho with Moses Carver to get supplies. And one day he saw a line of African-American children lined up outside of a house. And he said, what's that? And he said, well, that's a school for Negro children. And he said, well, I want to go there. And so the Carvers always encouraged him to learn. And after talking and praying, they went ahead and she cooked a bunch of loaves of bread for him. And he walked the 8 miles into town and slept in the loft of a barn. And the next day was taken in by Aunt Mariah and Uncle Andy Watkins, who were a childless African-American couple. And then he did odd jobs around town for people to earn money to pay for his tuition. And you think, how many 11-year-old orphans could you imagine going around town, ringing, you know, knocking on doors, and cooking and sweeping and, you know, carrying wood and cleaning stalls to earn money so that he could go and pay for his grade school education? Well, he was there for a year and a half in Neosho, and then learned all that Schoolmaster Foster could teach him. Hello?
Go ahead, Bill, can you hear me? Bill, are you there? Well, I guess we lost Bill. I'm going to ask our, if you'll just go ahead. Hello. Hello, Bill, are you there? We lost him. So let's go ahead and get him right back on the line. Well, anyway, this is Bill Federer, and he's telling us the story of George Washington Carver, certainly an amazing gentleman who was to have a profound impact on America, who was to have a profound impact on the world. And yet, of course, he comes from a slavery background. He is determined to get an education, and I'm going to let Bill pick up the story from there. Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, great. Well, I apologize for the phone here. But he left Neosho, Missouri, and went to Fort Scott, Kansas. And when he arrived, he lived in a lean-to behind a stagecoach depot. And then he found a wealthy family in town that he cooked for. And they were nice. They let him sleep in the underneath of their back porch. You know how they had back porch and stairs that went down, and there was a little crawl space. Well, that was his, where he lived. And anyway, he would go to the high school in town. And he experienced, you know, prejudice. And one time some kids beat him up and took his books and tore them up. And I mean, he had to pay for those books with the money that he earned himself. Another time he witnessed a lynching. And so he fled Fort Scott and went to Olathe, Kansas, and then to Paola, and then finally Minneapolis, Kansas. And I, you know, put that in there because, you know, we sometimes see, well, here's a guy that did great things with a peanut, and you don't realize, well, he did have to overcome a lot of obstacles. And that, to me, is the encouraging part of the story, because each of us face obstacles, and, you know, rather than give up, we need to overcome them. And I really, really appreciate Carver because he always had a forgiving and humble heart. Even though these prejudice acts were done toward him, he had the Lord that you know, caused him to be able to forgive those people. But Carver wrote that when he was there in Kansas, he got the word that his brother had died. He had one brother. His name was Jim, like I mentioned. And when he was there, he said, you know, word reached me that my brother Jim had died of smallpox. The sad news reached me here that James, my only brother, had died of smallpox. Being conscious as never before that I was left alone, I trusted God and pushed ahead. And I thought, you know, just imagine not having mother or brother, you know, just being all by himself. He says, in working for others, I had learned the minutiae of laundering. So I had opened a laundry for myself and got all the work that I could do. After finishing high school here, I made application to a certain college in Iowa. I was admitted. When the president saw that I was colored, he would not receive me. And, you know, you think of the disappointment there. He had gone back to Neosho with his acceptance letter and showed everybody and was so proud of it. And then he shows up at college. They wouldn't let him in. Then he went to Western Kansas and homesteaded for a few years, and the people there loved him. He taught, he would play his accordion. He said this in his, and I'm reading from these different letters that he wrote, but the thirst for knowledge gained the mastery, and I sought to enter Highland College at Highland, Kansas, but was refused on account of my color. I went from here to Western Kansas, where I saw the subject of my famous yucca and cactus painting that went to the World's Fair. And I drifted from here to Winterset, Iowa. So while he was out there, he'd sing for the people and he'd paint, and he learned how to farm, which later would help him to teach the farmers down in Alabama. Then he went to Kansas City and went into a business college and learned how to do shorthand and typewriting and worked for the Union Telegraph office as a stenographer. And then he went to Winterset, Iowa, and became the cook at a hotel. And when he was at the hotel, he writes, one evening I went to a white church and sat in the rear of the house. The next day, a handsome man called for me at the hotel and said his wife wanted to see me. When I reached the splendid residence, I was astonished to recognize her as a member of the choir. I was most astonished when she told me that my fine voice had attracted her. I had to sing quite a number of pieces for her and agreed to come to her house at least once a week. And from that time till now, Mr. and Mrs. Milholland have been my warmest and most helpful friends. I cooked at this hotel for some time, then opened a laundry for myself. I ran the laundry for 1 year. The same Mr. and Mrs. Milholland encouraged me to go to college. And he said that they chose Simpson College for me. And she encouraged me to paint, for which I had a passionate fondness, And in 1 year's time, I saved enough money to take me to Simpson College, where I studied art, music, and college work. I said, I opened a laundry here for my support. They had an empty building on campus, and they went ahead and let him, you know, turn it into a little laundry. And he washed the clothes of the other students. And then he said this, I would never allow anyone to give me money, no difference how badly I needed it. I wanted literally to earn my living. And I thought, what a deep, deep message in that short little sentence, that he had a pride in wanting to be able to support himself. And I thought, you know, that is an encouragement so much to all of us, but imagine the people that have, you know, may have been on welfare for two or three generations. You know, the Carver's life is an inspiration. Well, then he went ahead to Simpson College, and his teacher there was a Miss Etta Budd, a single young woman, and she noticed how intricately Carver painted plants. In one of his plants, the yucca, was a big, beautiful painting. It got an honorable mention in the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. So Carver was a very accomplished artist in his own right, but she, you know, said, you must really love plants. You paint them with such detail. And he goes, yes. And she said, you know, you could probably help more people in agriculture than you could in painting. And my father teaches at Iowa State College of Agriculture and Mechanical Arts. And so she and the others were able to get him in to Iowa State. And when he arrived, there weren't enough rooms for him. And the professor over the agricultural department was James Wilson. And this is what Carver wrote. He said, being a colored boy in the crowded condition of the school made it rather embarrassing for some, and it made a question of a room for me rather puzzling. Professor Wilson, as soon as he heard it, said, send him to me. I have a room. And he gave me his office and was very happy in doing so. So here's the head of the agricultural department lets Carver live in his office. And then he goes on to say, Wilson, the Honorable James Wilson, is sacred to me. He was one of the finest teachers that I ever had the privilege to listen to. He taught a Sunday school class in which every student would have enrolled if they had been allowed. The class grew so large that he conceived of a very unique plan to divide it, so he graduated some 20, 25 of us who had been with him the longest. I happened to be one of those graduated. We left him sad and reluctant and gave him to understand in no uncertain terms that we did not like it at all. But out of love for him we went, but we were all back less than 2 months. And he says, our displeasure grieved him, and he promised me many times that he would never try to divide the class again. And this same James Wilson went on to become the United States Secretary of Agriculture. And I thought, you know, two things. One, Carver's got some pretty impressive teachers, but secondly, he's going to a Sunday school class there at the college. And this is a letter that he wrote. Matter of fact, I'll read a letter that he wrote to the Mill Hollands. First from Simpson College. He said, I am taking better care of myself, this is 1890, than I have, because I realize that God has a great work for me to do, and I must be careful for my health. And you must doubtless be surprised to learn I'm taking voice, instrumental music, piano this term. I don't have to pay any direct money for my music, but I pay for it in my paintings. So he painted paintings and then traded them, sort of bartering. Anyway, he said, I'm glad the outlook for the upbuilding of the kingdom of Christ is so good. We are having a great revival here, 40 seeking last night, 25 arose for prayer at the close of the service. So, I mean, here Carver, when he was at Simpson, was going to a church where they had altar calls. And then a letter he writes to John and Helen Milholland from Iowa State in 1891. I do not like it as well here as I did at Simpson, because the helpful means for a Christian growth is not so good. But the Lord helping me, I will do the best I can. I'm glad to hear the work for Christ is progressing. Oh, how I wish people would awake from their lethargy and come out soul and body for Christ. And again, you know, it's neat for me to read the actual letters that Carver wrote, and he's mentioning his strong Christian faith. And I think that's a thing that's left out of the biographies that written about George Washington Carver.
Well, you know, that's the thing today. We find out this anti-Christian bias that permeates every aspect of our society today. I will certainly delete any mention of people's faith. And, you know, it's sort of like on television. They hardly, you know, all of these programs they have, even if they talk about God, they very, very, very seldom will talk about Jesus Christ. Have you noticed that?
Yes.
Touched by an angel, they're never allowed to mention Jesus Christ. It's all right to talk about God because God can be, you know, all sorts of gods, sort of ethereal being. But, of course, the Christian message is what really needs to be destroyed. So I think it's amazing to realize really the dedication, the commitment that George Washington Carver had and how that really certainly directed the whole course of his life.
Well, that's so true, and I'm not sure how much time before a break, but in going on there at Iowa State, he had another professor whose name was Henry C. Wallace, and Henry C. Wallace ends up becoming the United States Secretary of Agriculture for Warren G. Harding. So two of Carver's professors become Secretaries of Agriculture, and then Carver gets his a bachelor's degree. He's the first black graduate from college in the entire state of Iowa. Then he gets his master's degree, and he was in the Army Reserves there, and there's pictures of him in his uniform, and he was in the marching band. And then he gets a prestigious staff position as assistant botanist and is put over the greenhouses and the different laboratories. So he's becoming very well-respected by some very important people. And then one of his students is Henry A. Wallace, who is the son of Henry C., and Henry A. Wallace becomes U.S. Secretary of Agriculture and Vice President for Franklin D. Roosevelt. So Carver's, you know, rubbing shoulders with some very important people. Then he gets a letter, and the letter is from Booker T. Washington at Tuskegee Institute. This is 1896, and he writes, "Tuskegee Institute seeks to provide an education, a means of survival for those who attend. Our students are poor, often starving. They travel miles of torn roads and across years of poverty. We teach them to read and write, but words cannot fill stomachs. They need to learn how to plant and harvest crops." I love this next part. He said, "I cannot offer you money, position, or fame. The first two you have, the last from the place you now occupy, you will no doubt achieve. These things I now ask you to give up, and I offer you in their place work, hard, hard work, the challenge of bringing people from degradation, poverty, and waste to full manhood." Signed, Booker T. Washington. And then Carver writes back in 1896. He said, "My dear sir, I'm in receipt of your letter and am looking forward to doing all I can through Christ who strengtheneth me to better the condition of our people." And I thought, boy, isn't that neat. The very letter that Carver agrees to go to Tuskegee, he quotes a scripture. He says, "Through Christ who strengtheneth me to better the condition of our people." And then he said, "Some months ago I read your stirring address delivered at Chicago, and I said amen to all you said. Furthermore, you have the correct solution to the race problem. Providence permitting, I'll be with you in November." Well, the race problem that Carver refers to, Booker T. Washington and Carver thought that the answer is to work hard, get an education, make contributions to society, and you'll become respected. And that was on one side. The other side was a guy named W.E.B. Du Bois, who wrote demanding reparations and demanding restitution and demanding rights and so forth. And that sort of is the where Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton came from.
It sure did, and it really, that's of course this great debate that goes on today. You know, can man be free under God, or do we need the all-powerful ruling elite, the Al Sharptons and Jesse Jacksons? And Jesse Jackson's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and of course, he represents the elitist position, telling the black man, "You can't get ahead. But we need more government laws." And every time you pass a law, you take away more freedom. And, of course, you move the black and the white both closer to slavery and a return to a feudalistic society.
Oh, you're right. And that debate, you know, still goes on. And but I love Booker T. Washington as well. And I'll just give a little thumbnail history here. Booker T was born in slavery, and when the war ended, he and his family moved to West Virginia, where he worked in a salt mine and a coal mine, and would work all day long and then study till like 4 in the morning, and then work again and then study. And then he, at 16 years old, Booker T. Washington walked 500 miles to Virginia to go to Hampton Institute. It was founded by a Union general named Samuel Armstrong, and it was for freed slaves. So Booker T. Studies there, gets his degree, and then teaches several different places, and then in 1881 founds Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. And just to give you an insight into Booker T's life, one place he said that from the very beginning of my memory, I've always worked every single day, and there's not a day that goes by that I'm not working. He said that I can't remember once wasting a day with play. I thought, boy, this guy really did have a work ethic, you know. And he says this: in my efforts to raise money for Tuskegee Institute, I was surprised at the deep interest of ministers. He said, if no other consideration had convinced me of the value of the Christian life, the Christ-like work of the churches of all denominations in America have done in the last 35 years for the elevation of the black man would alone have made me a Christian. In a large degree, it was the pennies, nickels, and dimes which came in from all the Sunday schools, the Christian Endeavor societies, the missionary societies, as well as from the church proper, that have helped to elevate the Negro at such a rapid rate. And, you know, I thought it was interesting the references that he makes to, you know, Christianity. Here's another place. Booker T. Washington writes, while Tuskegee Institute is strictly undenominational, it is thoroughly Christian, and the spiritual training is not neglected. Our preaching service, our prayer meetings, our Sunday schools, our Christian Endeavor societies, young men's Christian associations, and missionary societies testify to this. He says, while the institution is in no sense denominational, we have a department known as the Phelps Hall Bible Training School, in which a number of students are prepared for ministry and other forms of Christian work. And, you know, so here, at Tuskegee, they're training people to be ministers, you know. And then another quote I like, he's talking about when he speaks in Atlanta, and then at Atlanta, they put it in the newspaper, and so the place was packed. And he says, the next morning before I went, I carefully went over what I planned to say. I also knelt down and asked God's blessing upon my effort. Right here, perhaps I ought to add that I make it a rule never to go before an audience on any occasion without asking the blessing of God upon what I was about to say. So Booker T. Washington was a great man and a great Christian man as well. And but back to the Carver story. Carver gets the letter from Booker T. and arrives in 1896 at Tuskegee. And it's an interesting story when they first get down there, because, you know, I'm paraphrasing, Carver is met there at the train station and arrives at the college, and he says, well, where's your agricultural department? And Booker T. takes him around and shows him the buildings and explains how every building was built from bricks that were made by the students right there on campus, and shows him one building after another. And Carver sort of, you know, inquires, well, you know, where's the agricultural building? And long story short, there was none. There was no equipment, no building, no anything, and Carver had to start it from scratch. And so he sent his students out to the junkyards and to the farms to gather broken bottles, and they'd turn the broken bottles upside down and make funnels out of them. And, you know, they'd take tubes off of this or pots and pans and, you know, turn them upside down or twist them this way or that and make all his laboratory equipment. And then he started noticing the needs of the farmers. Black sharecroppers, as well as the white farmers, they grew cotton. And cotton is a plant that every year you grow it, it produces less and less because it drains the soil of nutrients.
Well, I'm going to have to interrupt you here. We're going to be back in just a moment with Bill Federer, but we're going to take a little break here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and of course, you're out there in the listening audience. We hope many of you will take it upon yourself to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. And as you know, we start out the morning at 7 o'clock in the morning doing the American Freedom Network. We do the Genesis Network at 3 in the afternoon. Radio Liberty at 4. We do our evening program from 8 to 10. Tomorrow I'm going to do an extra 3 hours on a midnight program starting at midnight and going from then until 2 o'clock and 2:30 in the morning. But we do this because we feel we have to reach the American people. And if they don't understand the truth, which you're not going to get from the mainline media or from most of the mainline talk show hosts, we're going to continue down this same descent we have been in the past. World Radio Liberty is built upon my 40 years of research and having made an awful lot of mistakes during that time, but finally beginning to see how the whole incredible story fits together many, many weeks at a time, going through dusty files at Georgetown, certainly at Yale University, the Council on Foreign Relations, traveling throughout the world, interviewing ambassadors and generals and even the leader of one country. When I was in South Africa, I spent a part of an afternoon with John Forster, the president of the country, just the two of us talking. And you begin to get a feeling and understanding of what's really going on behind the scenes. And, of course, it's entirely different than you're taught in school. It's entirely different than most people believe. And there are powerful forces out there which really have their base in spiritual forces, but most people are unaware of them. They think we're involved in a political or cultural or ideological battle, and none of those are true. We're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. We'd love to hear from you. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, our latest newsletter deals with the possibility of biological warfare. Our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you haven't had a copy of our newsletter before, we'd be glad to send you one. And, of course, we hope that you want to get some of the material that will help you better to understand how to begin making preparations for what's going on today. Well, right now, of course, let's get back with our special guest this evening, Mr. William Federer, and telling you more of this incredible, incredible story of George Washington Carver. And we'll just hold calls until we get to the end of this. And Bill will be with us the second hour, so if you have questions or comments, why, hold them until then, please. Okay, Dr. Stan back here, and go ahead, Bill. Sorry to interrupt you, but we just have to do those things from time to time.
No, and I do encourage the listeners to support Radio Liberty and the work that you are doing, Stan. It's so important to get the truth out, and, you know, Samuel Adams, when we were fighting the British, had little newsletters called the Committees of Correspondence, and he would circulate the atrocities of the British because the king controlled the presses. But those little newsletters lit the fires of passion for freedom in America. And I think that if Samuel Adams were alive today, he'd be broadcasting the same way you are. And so you're doing a great work, and I encourage all the listeners to please dig in your pockets and support your ministry and organization.
Well, thanks so much, Bill.
In 1907, Carver writes a letter to Booker T. Washington about a Bible study that he was teaching at Tuskegee. And here it's May 28th, 1907. For your information only, Mr. B.T. Washington, he said, about 3 months ago, six or seven persons met my office one evening and organized a Bible class and asked me to teach it. I consented to start them off. Their idea was to put 20, 25 minutes on Sunday evenings, which intervened between supper and chapel service. We began the first of the Bible and attempted to explain the creation story. And then he goes on to say that attendance is 80 students, often as high as 114. Thought these facts would be helpful to you in speaking of the religious life of the school. And, again, all the different biographies that I've read on George Washington Carver, none of them mention that he led Bible studies at Tuskegee. But yet, when you read his own letters, which are in microfilm down there at Tuskegee. You can see this stuff in black and white, and so it's sort of been left out. Anyway, the situation for the farmers was very bad. Not only had the cotton depleted the soil, but the boll weevil came through. The boll weevil was an insect that ate the cotton, got inside the cotton ball and destroyed it. And when Carver was down there, he would have a wagon that he would put all of his laboratory stuff on, and he would go around with the wagon to the farms and instruct the farmers, who had never been through agricultural school, obviously, and instruct them how to turn the situation around from laying fields go fallow for a season to irrigation to fertilization to insecticide. But then he came back to planting legumes. Legumes are peanuts, sweet potatoes, soybeans, they're sort of roots, and they have a fungus that grows on the root that actually puts nitrogen back into the soil. And fertilizer is basically just nitrogen. And I used to work for the Santa Fe Industries, and they had a Gulf Central pipeline that shipped anhydrous ammonia from the Gulf of Mexico up on up to Iowa and Nebraska. And anhydrous ammonia is nothing but nitrogen. And when you plant the peanuts, it put this nitrogen back into the soil. And the farmers did it, and they would come up with these abundant crops, but then they had more peanuts than the market wanted because they were using peanuts primarily for animal feed. And so the farmers were needing more people to buy the peanuts, so Carver went into his laboratory and created hundreds of uses for the peanut. And all scholars admit that he is responsible for creating the $500 million peanut industry, which is how big it grew by the time of his death. And now it's a multi-billion dollar industry. But here's a little talk that Carver gave in 1920 to the Young Men's Christian Association in Blue Ridge, North Carolina. And he said, "Years ago, I went into my laboratory and said, 'Dear Mr. Creator, can you tell me what the universe was made for?' The great Creator answered, 'You want to know too much for that little mind of yours. Ask something more your size, little man.' Then I asked, 'Please, Mr. Creator, can you tell me what man was made for?' Again, the great Creator replied, 'You're still asking too much. Cut down on the extent and improve on the intent.' So I asked, 'Please, Mr. Creator, can you tell me what the peanut was made for?' 'That's better, but even that's infinite. What do you want to know about the peanut?' 'Mr. Creator, can I make milk out of a peanut?' 'What kind of milk do you want to make? Good Jersey milk or just plain boarding house milk?' 'Good Jersey milk.' Then the great Creator taught me to take apart the peanut and put it back together again, and out of that process has come forth all these products." And then he adds, 3.5 ounces of peanuts produces 1 pint of milk. And but he created from peanut brittle to shaving cream to cosmetic cream to diesel fuel to axle grease, just on and on. There's a huge list of items: chili sauce, chopped suey sauce, Worcester sauce, oleo margarine, mayonnaise, peanut brittle. I mentioned that caramel chocolate. Chocolate-coated peanuts, after-dinner mints, synthetic tapioca, castor oil, quinine, laxatives, face cream, cold cream, hand lotion, rubbing oil, face powder, talcum powder, bleach, molasses, hog feed, fertilizer, leather stains from mahogany to blue, shoe polish, blackening leather polish, metal polish, writer's ink, printer's ink, pigments from which crayons were made. You know, lead paint is poisonous. So Carver created these pigments that crayons were made from, where you can have a kid eat a crayon and they won't die. And it's, adhesives he made, alcohol, paper, rope, cordage, mat, synthetic cotton, asphalt from the hulls, plastics, laundry soap, sweeping compound, wall boards, linoleum, insulating boards, creosote, gasoline, diesel fuel, briquettes, the list just goes on and on, and to think that he made it all out of peanuts. And then the industry grows, and there are a whole lot of farmers that plant the peanuts, and they ask Carver, they form the United Peanut Growers Association, and they ask Carver to go to Washington, D.C., and lobby Congress for a tariff on imported peanuts, because they were shipping them in from China cheaper than they could be grown here in America. So Carver gets up there. It's January 21st, 1921. And, you know, interesting story. It shows how humble Carver was. He wore one suit and would put a new flower in the lapel every day. So the suit, you know, got pretty ragged looking after a while. And he shows up at the door of the Capitol, and the doorman wouldn't let him in. And Carver was too humble of a person to, you know, force his way in, so he just sort of waited and waited and waited, and I think they sent him back and forth on different wild goose chases to different buildings, and finally it's you know, about 4:50 in the afternoon, and the people, the congressmen, are wondering why Carver never showed up, and one of them goes down to the door and inquires, and, you know, to his embarrassment, Carver was waiting there the whole time, so they bring him in. It's the House Ways and Means Conference and Committee, and they say, well, it's late in the day. You got 10 minutes to talk. And I don't know about you, but that would be an overcoming opportunity emotionally to travel all the way from Alabama to Washington, D.C., and, you know, all of a sudden they cut you down to just 10 minutes. But Carver's not flustered, and he just, you know, stands before the congressman and opens up his bag and starts pulling out all the different things he's created out of the peanut. And he says, if you go to the first, and this is directly from the records of Congress, he says, if you go to the first chapter of Genesis, we can interpret very clearly, I think, what God intended when he said, behold, I have given you every herb that bears seed. To you it shall be meat. This is what he means about it. It shall be meat. There is everything there to strengthen and nourish and keep the body alive and healthy. And you know, you go to a Jack in the Box or one of those hamburger places and say, well, this isn't a real hamburger. This is a soy burger, you know, because it's made out of soybeans. Well, Carver's the one that was able to take a soybean and turn it into the texture and flavor of meat. I mean, he was brilliant. And they're so impressed that the chairman of the committee says, your time is unlimited. And he ends up talking an hour and 45 minutes. And it's funny because I've read through the questioning session, and some of the congressmen, he pulls out the one bottle and says, you can make milk out of the peanut. And the one congressman says, well, I'm from a milk-producing state, and is this going to be competition for my, you know, farmers? And Carver says, no, it's not going to, you know, it's not going to grow that. And then he talks about how he can turn the peanut into meat. And the one from a beef state says, well, you know, my state produces beef, and are you going to end up infringing on the beef market? And he goes, no. It sounds just like politics there. But when he's done, the chairman of the committee says, Dr. Carver, how do you learn all these things? Carver replied, from an old book. What book? Asked the chairman. Carver replied, the Bible. Chairman inquired, does the Bible tell about peanuts? No, sir, Carver said. It tells about the God who made the peanut. I asked him to show me what to do with the peanut, and he did. So here, Carver's speaking before Congress and giving God and the Bible credit for all these tremendous things that he's created out of the peanut. Fascinating, fascinating story.
Well, it really is. And, of course, you know, that probably would meet with a lawsuit by the ACLU today if you were to go before Congress and talk about God. And yet, of course, in years past, God was the basis of everything. And this realization that, you know, we have to really look to him for our solace, for our intelligence, for our strength.
Exactly. And here's a letter that Carver wrote to one of his students. The students pitched in and gave him a fountain pen. And he said, I wish to express to you and to each member of the senior class my deep appreciation for the fountain pen you so kindly and thoughtfully gave to me. This gift, like all others, is characterized by simplicity and thoughtfulness and so on and so forth. And then he says, as your father, it is needless for me to keep, because he called himself, you know, the father of the students. He says, it is needless for me to keep saying I hope, except for emphasis, that each one of my children, students, will rise to the full height of your possibilities, which means the possession of these eight cardinal virtues, which constitute a lady or gentleman. And this is the eight cardinal virtues which Carver encourages students. 1, be clean both inside and out. 2, who neither looks up to the rich nor down to the poor. 3, who loses, if needs be, without squealing. 4, who wins without bragging. 5, who is always considerate of women, children, and old people. 6, who is too brave to lie. 7, who is too generous to cheat. 8, who takes his share of the world and lets other people have theirs. May God help you carry out these 8 cardinal virtues, and peace and prosperity be yours. And I thought, you know, those are some great little lines for life. And I like that last one, 8, who takes his share of the world and lets other people have theirs. And, you know, sometimes it's such a temptation if you see other people doing stuff or having stuff and, you know, and say, well, you know, let them be blessed and God will give you your portion. Well, Carver continues to speak and his influence grows and he gets invited to speak in New York City at the Collegiate Church, the Marble Collegiate Church, for the Women's Board of Domestic Missions, 500 people. It's November 19th, 1924. He says, God is going to reveal things to us he never revealed before if we put our hands in his. No books ever go into my laboratory. The thing I am to do and the way of doing it are revealed to me. I never have to grope for methods. The method is revealed to me the moment I am inspired to create something new. Without God to draw aside the curtain, I would be helpless. And, I mean, that sounds like a nice little talk. Well, anyway, the New York Times got a hold of that talk that I just read, and they blasted Carver. They wrote an editorial saying, men of science never talk that way. And they make fun of his race and his religion. And Carver writes back to them on November 24th, 1924, he sends a letter to the editor of the New York Times, and he said, I've read with much interest your editorial pertaining to myself in the issue of November 20th. I regret exceedingly that such a gross misunderstanding should arise at what was meant by divine inspiration. Inspiration is never at a variance with information. In fact, the more information one has, the greater will be the inspiration. Paul the great scholar said in 2 Timothy 2:15, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. And again, Paul said in Galatians 1:12, for I neither received it from man, neither was I taught it, but it was by revelation of Jesus Christ. Many other equally strong passages could be cited, but these two are sufficient to form the base on which to cluster my remarks. And for those listening, the first one talked about studying, which was information. The second scripture talked about revelation, you know, from Jesus Christ, so that would be the inspiration. But he says, I'm a graduate of Iowa State College of Agriculture in Ames, Iowa. I hold 2 degrees in scientific agriculture. I did considerable work at Simpson College in Indianola, Iowa. In chemistry, I've studied under Justin von Liebig, Dr. Leroy Blinn, Dr. Rasmussen, and he lists dozens and dozens and dozens of people that he studied under or studied their works, including Madame Curie, who developed the X-ray and radiology, and then botany, and he lists a whole lot of professors, and goes on and on. Finally, he said, while in your beautiful city of New York, I was struck by the large number of Taros and Yautias, and I know I'm not pronouncing that right, Yautias, displayed in your markets. They are edible roots imported from Trinidad, Puerto Rico, China, Dutch Guiana, Peru. As soon as I saw these luscious roots, I marveled at the possibilities for their expansion. Dozens of ideas came to mind while looking at them. I would follow the same plan that I pursued in developing products from the white potato. I know of no one who has ever worked with these roots in this way. I know of no book from which I can get this information. Yet I will have no trouble in performing this. If this is not inspiration from a source greater than myself, kindly tell me what it is, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And I thought, you know, isn't that, I mean, it's very clear what he meant, and it makes sense. And, you know, here the New York Times was making fun of him, but he wrote an excellent letter. And then that catapulted Carver into national prominence because people started writing letters to the editor of the New York Times defending Carver. And then other people, you know, I mean, it sort of became a debate back and forth, and Carver was the center of it. But he started getting letters from around the world. And here's one letter that he wrote back to Reverend Lyman Ward of Camp Hill, Alabama, in January 15th, 1925. He says, "My dear brother Ward, I did indeed feel very badly for a while, not that the cynical criticism was directed at me, but rather at the religion of Jesus Christ. Dear brother, I know that my Redeemer liveth. I believe that through the providence of the Almighty, it was a good thing. Since the criticism was made, I have had dozens of books, papers, periodicals, magazines, personal letters from individuals in all walks of life. Copies of the letters to the editors of the New York Times are bearing me out in my assertion." And he goes on to say how, you know, people are defending him, you know, and defending the inspiration. And in the book I put pictures of Carver, and there's one picture of him sitting in front of a table with a 3-foot-high stack, big pile of letters, just a huge pile. And he was getting letters from around the world. Even Mahatma Gandhi in India was sending him letters. And he even got letters from Joseph Stalin inviting him to Russia. And he said, "No, my students will go around the world. I won't." But, you know, what was meant, you know, the one scripture says what the devil meant for evil, God turned around for good, you know.
Well, I think that, you know, it's really so interesting that even back in 1921, the people who controlled the New York Times, just as today, had an intense hatred of Christianity. And this is what it was all about, ridiculing him for daring, of course, to refer to the Bible. And, of course, it was, you know, it took them another 35 years or more, almost 40 years, 41 years, before, of course, the majority of the members of the Supreme Court were anti-Christian, members of the Masonic Lodge, and could take God and prayer out of our schools. But there has always been this conflict between people who believed in the Bible, which makes up really the majority of our society, at least it did at one time, and still does, I really think, and then these people, these anti-Christian bigots who would destroy Christianity and replace our society with this ruling elite, of course with themselves as part of the elite that would rule this new feudalistic system, which of course they refer to as democratic socialism, but in reality is nothing more than a return to feudalism of yesteryear.
Well, you're exactly right. And another part, you mentioned the Bible. Here's a letter that Carver wrote. And again, the book I wrote is called George Washington Carver, His Life and Faith in His Own Words.
Well, incidentally, if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to know more about that book, George Washington Carver, His Life and Letters, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we can tell you how you can get it if you're interested in the book. Again, the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. The book on George Washington Carver, easy reading, a wonderful, heartwarming story, the sort of story that makes you proud to be an American.
Definitely, definitely. Well, this is one of the letters he wrote in March 24th, 1925, to Reverend Kunzman of Seattle. He said, "My lifetime study of nature in its many phases leads me to believe more strongly than ever in the biblical account of man's creation as found in Genesis 1:27. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he them. Male and female created he them." And he says, "Of course, sciences throughout ages have been searching for the so-called missing link, which enables us to interpret man from the very beginning of civilization to the present. But I am fearful lest our finite searches will be wholly unable to grasp the infinite detail of creation, and therefore we lose the great truth of the creation of man." So he, you know, says right in there that he believes in more and more in the biblical account of man's creation. And in several other places in here, you know, he talks about how he's not one of the ones to believe in the evolution and so forth. Another letter he wrote is in 1927, and I like to bring out these letters where he mentions his faith. for several reasons, but one is I've talked to so many chaplains that work in prisons where they say that the Muslims are going in there telling them that Christianity is the white man's religion and Islam is the black man's religion. And, I mean, I was on Ollie North's radio show last week up in Washington, D.C., and you know, talking about this very thing, and he agreed that this is something that we need to address because more and more people that, you know, they're upset that they are in prison to begin with, and unfortunately 70% of the people in prison are from the African-American race, and they're upset at the white system for putting them in there, and then this religion comes along of Islam saying, you know, the white man is Satan, you know, black Islam. And so scores and scores of these people are converting, and so the ministers go into the prisons with Bibles and find these people are hostile. They not only won't take a Bible, but they'll get hostile toward them. And so it's something that if we don't address this now, and again, the person, the sniper that did all the killings in, you know, Washington, D.C. and Virginia, they were Muslim, black Muslims, you know. But that's a different part of the story. That's not all what I'm talking about tonight. But I wanted to highlight an African-American man who was a great scientist who was also a Christian. And so this book is a collection of his letters that he wrote. And this is one letter in March 1st, 1927, to Jack Boyd, the YMCA official in Denver, Colorado. He says, I want my students to find Jesus and make him a daily, hourly, and momently part of themselves. And he says, my friend, keep your hand in the hand of the Master and walk daily by his side so that you may lead others into realms of real happiness, where a religion of hate, which poisons the body and soul, will be unknown, having in its place the golden rule way, which is the Jesus way of life, will reign supreme. Then we can walk and talk with Jesus momently, because we will be attuned to his will and wishes. And it just goes on and on.
Well, we're going to have to interrupt you there. We're going to have to take a break here. So for our listeners in the Great Northwest, we want to bid you good night. And, of course, Bill, you hang on. We're looking forward to having you with us this next hour. But to the listeners in the Great Northwest, why, please pray for America. Pray for peace. And if it is not going to be peace, why, pray for certainly for our boys and for the Arabs over there as well, both Christian and Muslim. And then, of course, please remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Good night. Well, good evening, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, our guest this evening is Bill Federer. And Bill, of course, is an author. He's a lecturer. He actually ran for Congress twice against Dick Gephardt. And if Dick Gephardt hadn't cheated and spent some $6 million, I think that Bill Federer would be in Washington, D.C. today, but then he wouldn't be able to be with us here. So I view what happened with mixed emotions. I'm glad he's here. We're hoping that he's going to run next time. And if he does, why, we will have another man of principle back in Washington, D.C. Dick is very well known in his area. And if it hadn't been for all the shenanigans and dishonesty of the Democrat machine there and keeping the polls open and, all the other things that they did, why, Bill certainly would have won those elections. So, but this evening we've been talking about George Washington Carver. And, of course, Bill has written all sorts of fascinating books. We actually carry his book, America's God and Country. And, of course, so many quotations from our founding fathers as to their Christian faith. And then, of course, there's a CD of that, which is available for your computer with a lot more quotations on. And then another CD with 1,000 manuscripts on it, 1,000 important books. And then, of course, he has the book on St. Patrick and one, Is There a Santa Claus? And then this one on George Washington Carver. Have I missed any, Bill?
I have another one that it was out of print, but I'm going to have it back in print, called The Treasury of Presidential Quotations.
And then what about your one on the Declaration?
Yes. And there's several others that I have in the works, including my American Minute. I send out a daily email called An American Minute, and we're going to be, what happened on each date in American history.
Well, why don't you get your email and your website out there so people know how to get in touch with you.
Oh, great. Well, it's www.amerisearch.net. And Amerisearch is spelled A-M-E-R-I-S-E-A-R-C-H, Amerisearch.net. And there's a American Minute newsletter that you can sign up for. And it's just a little 100-word thing that you get every day, but it's what happened on each date in American history from a, patriotic God and country perspective.
Now, does this come by email, by fax, or how?
By email.
All right, fine.
And but it's a great little inspiration, and, with all the efforts to remove our faith, I was on an airplane one time with a couple U.S. senators, and one of them had my book, America's God and Country, and the other one hadn't. So I was showing the other senator, and she was amazed. She said, "Wow, I didn't know all this. Send me a copy." And so I sent her a copy, and she sent me a real nice thank you note. But it dawned on me that here's somebody who was a U.S. senator and didn't know the stuff that was in this book. And, back in the early states, you not only had to lay your hand upon a Bible to swear into office, you had to swear you believed in the Bible in order to hold office, which makes sense. Why would you lay your hand on a book you didn't believe in? May as well swear in on a cookbook. But, here, you assume that if somebody is a senator, that they ought to be experts in American history and on the Constitution and on the in actual fact, they spend all their time, trying to read these 20,000-page bills, or trying to run for re-election, or trying to raise money or trying to fight lies that the other side is spending about them, saying about them, and It's like one congressman I talked to, he said, Bill, ever since I got elected, it's just been a whirlwind. And he said, I haven't had any time to sit down and go to a library and look at old dusty quotes. He says, I just carry your book with me. You know.
Well, I bet you see, that's the wonderful thing about writing books. You know, this can be a constant source of information for others. And your book is over, it's 800 pages. It's hardback. And it's got a great index in the back. A book without an index is like, you know, meat without salt. It really is not very good. And basically, if you want to look up and see what George Washington said or Benjamin Franklin or John Adams or Samuel Adams, and it's, of course, they're all arranged alphabetically, which helps. But, of course, it's nice to be able to just flip over to the page and find out what they said about their faith. And you find out that the men who created this country had a deep and abiding faith, and most of them, the vast majority of them, were dedicated Christians. In contrast to many of the websites, you'll go up on the Internet now, and they will tell you that this one wasn't a Christian and that wasn't a Christian, and, you know, and they're simply lies. But if you don't have the source of the original information, how do you know what the truth is? And once you understand there is an effort out there to destroy the Christian foundation of this country, then so much of what's going on is self-explanatory, and these websites put out by the anti-Christian bigots is certainly understandable.
Oh, you're exactly right. And, you know, I want to get to Carver, but the one person I thought was interesting, I was talking to a guy named Jerry Newcomb, and he is the television producer for D. James Kennedy, and we've become friends, and he called me today because we're going to be at the NRB next week, and we were talking about Timothy Dwight, and Timothy Dwight was the president of Yale College.
And wasn't he the grandson of Jonathan Edwards?
Right, he was the grandson of Jonathan Edwards, and he wrote a article. And this article is printed in the Annals of America. Now, this is a, you know, like a 40-volume set of books printed by Encyclopedia Britannica. This isn't anything that's fake. I mean, it's real. It's printed in Encyclopedia Britannica, Annals of America. This was a speech he gave in July 4th, 1798, in New Haven. And he said, about the year 1728, Voltaire, so celebrated for his wit and brilliancy and not less distinguished for his hatred of Christianity and his abandonment of principle, formed a systematical design to destroy Christianity and to introduce in its stead a general diffusion of irreligion and atheism. For this purpose, he associated himself with Frederick II, King of Prussia, and Monsieur d'Albert and Diderot, the principal compilers of the Encyclopedia, all men of talents, atheists, and the like men are abandoned. The principal part of their systems were, :1, compilation of the Encyclopedia, in which the great art and insidiousness of the doctrines of natural as well as Christian theology were rendered absurd and ridiculed, and the mind of the reader was insensibly steeled against the conviction and duty. 2, the overthrow of the religious orders in the Catholic countries, a step essentially necessary to the destruction of the religion professed in those countries. 3, the establishment of a sect of philosophists to serve, it is presumed, as a conclave, a rallying point for followers. You know, 4th, and he goes on, you know, 5th, he says, the fabrication of books of all kinds against Christianity, especially to excite doubt and general contempt. You know, he goes on and on. Then he says, while these measures were advancing, the great design with a regular and rapid progress, Dr. Adam Weishaupt, professor of canon law in the University of Ingolstadt, a city in Bavaria, Germany, formed about the year 1777 the Order of Illuminati. This order is professedly a high order of Masons originated by himself and grafted onto the ancient Mason institutions. And in the societies of the Illuminati, the doctrines were taught which strike at the root of all human happiness and virtue. And he says, the being of God was denied and ridiculed, the possession of property denounced, chastity was declared nothing more than groundless prejudices. And I mean, it just goes on and on. And some of this stuff you know, people think, well, that's all made up stuff. But here, this was in, you know, the professor, the president of Yale College, writing a speech that's printed in the Annals of America in 1798. So there is a plan of people whose purpose is to eradicate Christianity.
Well, now, do you have that in one of your books, that speech by Timothy Dwight?
Yes, that's in my American Quotation CD-ROM.
Okay, that's American Quotation. That's now, that American Quotations, is that that's the one that we carry?
Yes, yes.
Okay, fine. Now, that's the one that comes to America, God, and Country?
Right, right. It
okay.
has the America's God and Country, all the quotes from America's God and Country, plus extra quotes.
And I think it's really so important, ladies and gentlemen, that you understand that Timothy Dwight here in 1798 was writing about the Illuminati, a secret society that still exists to this very day. And we've talked to people who have been affiliated with this, people like Bill Snevelin, certainly well aware of the influence of the Illuminati at the upper echelons of the esoteric societies. They exist to this very, very day. We even have something that Dr. Cuddy and I were able to get out of the Jeffersonian collection back at the Library of Congress with great difficulty. We have it. It's called the Clintonian Illuminati, and it was written in 1803 or 1804, and it has nothing to do with Bill Clinton. It had to do with Governor Clinton at that time. We have letters that George Washington wrote about 1798 about the Illuminati. And we have, of course, going to Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma, written in 1871. He talks about the Illuminati. Now, if you go to the modern-day encyclopedia, you will find it's been totally extricated. You will find really almost no mention at all of the Illuminati. And none of the things you'll find in the 1911 British Encyclopedia Britannica, because they've simply censored it, as they've removed any mention of Mazzini and the other secret societies and the conspirators working within the shadows. How have they been able to remove these concepts from the minds of the American people? Why, they call it censorship. In Germany, they burnt the books. In America, they simply rewrite the books and delete the important facts, put them down the memory hole, as George Orwell described so well in The Society of Big Brother. And what's so interesting is the symbol of the Illuminati, and of course all the ancient mystery religions and Masonry itself, was a pyramid cap on all-seeing eye. You see it on the back of the Great Seal of the United States, but there in 1782, you see it on the back of the dollar bill in 1935, and it's still there. But what's so interesting is it appears on the DARPA website, Admiral Poindexter's DARPA website, and we'll be putting that up on our website so you can see it. The pyramid capped by the all-seeing eye, how flagrant can they be? They must hold the American people in total disdain, thinking that they are so stupid they can brandish these things in plain sight, and nobody will understand that where they are in effect saying is, we are really the last stage in this move of the mystery religions towards the New World Order, the New World Religion. And the emblem that they've added is knowledge is power. That knowledge is power. Belief, the pyramid capped by the all-seeing eye. And but the knowledge is, they're going to know everything about you. That's what DARPA is all about. Monitoring, they call it mining of information, and getting on the computers, everything you buy, everything you say, combining echelon, the monitoring of your telephone calls, monitoring of your emails, monitoring of your faxes, monitoring of where you go and what you buy, your medical records, your legal records, everything is there. And then, of course, their symbol, the pyramid capped by the all-seeing eye, which is what was used by the ancient mystery religions, by the Illuminati, and by Admiral Poindexter, appointed by President George W. Bush.
One of the other quotes in here from the Timothy Dwight in his speech in 1798, he said, "Where religion prevails, Illuminatis cannot make disciples. A French Directory cannot govern." And the French Directory is, you know, what happened in the French Revolution, those people. He says, "A nation cannot be made slaves, nor villains, nor atheists, nor beasts." He said, "To destroy us, therefore, in this dreadful sense, our enemies must first destroy our Sabbath and seduce us from the house of God. Religion and liberty are the two great objects of defensive war. Conjoined, they unite all feelings and call forth all the energies of man. And he says, religion and liberty are the meat and drink of politic. Withdraw one, and it languages, consumes, and dies. If indifference to either at any time becomes the prevailing character of the people, one half of their motives to vigorous defense is lost. And, you know, he says, without religion, we may possibly retain the freedom of savages, bears, and wolves, but not the freedom of New England. If our religion were gone, our state of society would perish, and with it, nothing would be left worth defending. And but, you know, what you've written in The Brotherhood of Darkness, which my wife has been reading for the first time and just loves, she says, be sure to tell Dr. Stan how I love his book that we picked up when we were with you in the conference short time ago. But what you wrote, I mean, here in 1798, the president of Yale saying virtually the same thing.
Right. But people have recognized this all down through the centuries. My grandfather told my father about the Illuminati. And, of course, my father never told me until I was, you know, involved in this conservative movement, probably in the late 1960s, early 1970s, because, of course, this is totally eradicated from modern-day textbooks, and yet you cannot understand anything going on today unless you understand the secret societies. In fact, one of our listeners just got me a book that was published in 1885. He found it in a used bookstore. It's called The Great Conspiracy, and it's talking about the Civil War. And the Knights of the Golden Circle, a secret society with secret handshakes and oaths, and you died if you revealed any of their secrets, 1 million members. How would you conceal today an organization with 1 million members during the Civil War? The Knights of the Golden Circle were hoping to put that up on our website as well. But you see, if you control the media and you control the major publishers, then you ultimately control what the American people think.
Yes, yes. I spoke in Milwaukee over the weekend, and I was telling them, you know, don't get discouraged when you hear all these different type of things. I said, every era of history, there's always been crises. And in a sense, God allows there to be crises to see what we're made of. You know, you don't know what's in a toothpaste tube till you squeeze it, you know. And it's like he lets the crises come to see who... if we really, really trust in him. And then secondly, it's in times of crises that people turn to Christ. Most people don't come to Christ and everything's perfect in their life. There's some crises of some sort that they can't handle, and we look up and turn to Jesus. But the second thing is, in times of crises, that great leaders rise up. And whether that leader is a Moses or a David or a Joshua or a Gideon or, you know, a George Washington, you know, it's in times of crises that, you know, people let the Lord use them to rise up to make a difference. And I think that, you know, when we get to heaven and we're going to face the Apostle Paul and all the great saints of old, and they're going to tell us all their exploits, when they get done telling everything, you know, they're going to look you right in the eye and say, well, now you tell me, what did you do when you were on earth? You know, what were the great exploits that you did? What were they saying about God in your country, and what did you do about it? And so, in a sense, if you look at it from the point of view of, yeah, there's lots of problems, but this gives me something to do that I can put in effort to try to turn it around for good, and that's what we're going to talk about, you know, for eternity is what we did on Earth. So it's like, you know, I played sports in high school, and you know, imagine if your team was winning by 20 touchdowns and the coach sends you in the game. Well, that's not going to be too exciting, because you know, you could do anything, and you know, but what if your team is like it's tied up and it's neck and neck, and you know, there's just 2 minutes left in the game, and the coach pats you on the back and says, go in there and you know, run a touchdown, and so, you know, you get to be somebody that can make a difference. And that's the way it is. You know, sometimes I look at, you know, the world that we're in, and that, you know, if everybody was saved and everybody was a Christian and everything was perfect and we were born into this world, it wouldn't be a whole lot, you know, for us to do that would make a difference. But no, we're neck and neck with the forces of darkness. And God's slapped us on the rear end and had us be born, you know, and here we are. And he's like, okay, get out there and make a difference, you know, win the game.
No, you know, I think, Bill, one reason I do what I do is to try to let people realize there is a problem. And my basic contention is that you can't sell the life insurance unless you can convince people they're going to die. And you can't get people really to come to the Lord unless you realize, make them realize they need the Lord. And, you know, of course, as you know, I practiced medicine for many years. And most doctors don't need the Lord. I mean, after all, you know, you cure people and you put them back together again, and it's a wonderful thing to be able to do that. But, of course, if you don't realize that you're really dependent upon the Lord, I never healed a bone. All I did was put them in place, and the wonderful system that God created healed those bones and repaired the tendons that I sewed together. But, of course, when you're doing it, you're not thinking about God. It's only when something affects your life very, very deeply, and suddenly you realize, I can't do this alone. I need the Lord. And, you know, I hope maybe what I do and what you do and what the other people who are involved in this battle are doing is touching the lives of people and pointing them in the right direction. And if we point them in the right direction, then God will do the rest. But all we can do is perhaps be the catalyst to bring them to an awareness of the fact that this wonderful utopian society, this Camelot we live in, that we think is so secure, you know, and we have all this money in the bank. Or, of course, I don't have all that money in the bank, but an awful lot of people do. And but they think that there's tremendous security in that. But the only security we will have is, of course, in our Savior. And of course, somebody once said, "You never saw a hearse going to the graveyard with a U-Haul trailer behind it." We came into the world without anything. We will leave without anything. And of course, if our society goes into crisis, which I think it's going to very, very soon, we can lose everything materially we have. And the only thing that will sustain us is our personal relationship with our Lord.
Amen. Amen. Well, I totally agree with you that everything that can be shaken will be shaken, but that's whatever is built on the rock, Christ Jesus, will stand. And but hopefully we can get a few minutes to finish up talking about George Washington Carver.
Well, let's go right ahead and finish up George Washington Carver right now.
And I talked about how he spoke in New York at the Marble Collegiate Church, and then the New York Times made fun of his talk because he talked about divine inspiration. And then he wrote a letter back to the editor of the New York Times. It got printed, and then the publicity of that, it catapulted George Washington Carver into the national spotlight, and he was getting letters from around the world and speaking engagements from around the world and around the country, rather. And but then we look at his life and see the faith that he had, and I'm just going to read a couple other different letters that he wrote to people. This is one of my favorite ones. He wrote in 1928 to Jim Hardwick. And he said, "As a very small boy exploring the almost virgin woods of the old Carver place, I had the impression that someone had been there just ahead of me. Things were so orderly, so clean, so harmoniously beautiful. A few years later in the same woods, I was to understand the meaning of this boyish impression because I was practically overwhelmed with some great presence. Not only had someone been there, someone was there. Years later, I read the scripture, 'In him we live and move and have our being.' I knew what the writer meant. Never since have I been without this consciousness of the Creator speaking to me." And then Carver, you know, because the book, I put down a little subtitle, says, "Discover the Inspiration That Motivated This Great American Scientist." And so, you know, what motivated him? Well, here he says it. He says, "Man, who needed a purpose, a mission to keep him alive, had one. He could be God's co-worker. My attitude toward life was my attitude toward science. Jesus said one must be born again, must become a little child. He must let no laziness, no fear, no stubbornness keep him from his duty. If he were born again, he would see life from such a plane that he would have the energy not to be impeded in his duty by these various sidetrackers." And he said, "My purpose alone must be God's purpose, to increase the welfare and happiness of his people. Nature will not permit a vacuum. It will be filled with something. human need is really a great spiritual vacuum which God seeks to fill. With one hand in the hand of a fellow man and the other in the hand of Christ, he could get across the vacuum, and I became an agent. Then the passage, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me," came to have real meaning. As I worked on projects which fulfilled the real human need, forces were working through me which amazed me. I would often go to sleep at night with an apparently insoluble problem. When I awoke, the answer was there. Why then should we who believe in Christ be so surprised at what God can do with a willing man in a laboratory? Some things must be baffling to the critic who has never been born again. And I thought, boy, this is such a powerful message and so clear and so, you know, he didn't grow up in church. He grew up as born a slave and then raised by the German immigrant couple. And then, so his faith has that pureness to it, that he didn't learn a whole bunch of religious terminologies. I mean, it was a real experience to him. But he loved the Scripture. And you read these letters, he's always quoting from the Scripture. You know, here's another letter he wrote. And he says, in John chapter 8, in the 32nd verse, we see this statement, "And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And he says in the 12th chapter of Job, the 7th and 8th verses, we are urged, thus, he says, "But ask now the beasts, and they shall teach thee, and the fowls of the air, they shall tell thee, or speak to the earth, and it shall teach thee, and the fishes of the sea shall declare unto thee," you know, how, you know, all nature declares the glory of God. And neat stuff in this book.
It really is a wonderful book. It's such a heartwarming book, and that's why, and if any of your listeners out there are interested in learning more about the book on George Washington Carver and you'd like to know more about it, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WARREN. And you just read all of these, so many of these letters, didn't you?
Yes, yes. I read them right from the book, and the last chapter of Carver's life, the last 10 years of his life, he spent praying for people and trying to bring healing to their limbs. In the 1930s, this was before Dr. Jonas Salk developed a vaccine for polio. So many, many people got polio, and their limbs became atrophied, their muscles became useless. And there was also infantile paralysis, and this was a terrible condition. And Carver responded. He wanted to help, and so he developed the oil out of peanuts to use to help massage these limbs. And there are many documented cases of people who improved, and almost miraculously. And the Associated Press even carried an article about this, December of 1933. Now, today, physicians acknowledge that the peanut oil probably didn't do much other than keep the skin from being rubbed raw. But in actual fact, Carver was pioneering the field of physical therapy, of, you know, massaging and working the limbs to get the use back. This is one of the letters he wrote. He says, "I have patients who come to me on crutches who are now walking 6 miles without tiring, without either a crutch or a cane. My last patient today was one of the sweetest little 5-year-old boys who 3 months ago they had to carry into my room, being paralyzed from the waist down. When I finished the massage today, much to our astonishment, he dressed himself, stood up, walked across the floor without any support." And he says, "I said these are our patients because I feel that your prayers help make this possible. Since last December, I've received over 2,000 letters, plus people who come every day almost every night for treatment. It is truly marvelous what God is doing." Another place he writes in 1935 to Reverend Thomas O. Parrish of Topeka, Kansas. He says, "Marvelous. Some come to me on crutches and canes and in time go away walking. One father brought his dear little afflicted boy 200 miles to me this morning, infantile paralysis. How I thank you for your prayers. A Georgia pastor of a large church just informed me that the whole congregation prayed for me last night."
We're going to be back in just a moment here with Bill Federer and the story of George Washington Carver. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. And, of course, 5 hours on radio, 5 hours on the Internet, 3 hours on satellite, 2 hours on shortwave, and we're hoping and praying that we're going to be able to expand and get our programs up on the satellite, the evening programs. And then, of course, we will get it syndicated and try to get other stations to pull it down, and perhaps you can call your local stations when we do this and see if they'll be willing to pull this down on a barter basis. This is how we can really get more and more and more people to hear the truth, the story behind the story, the news behind the news. Our battle has to be to inform the people about the true nature of what this battle is about the spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged today. So if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family, you don't have to be bashful. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, and the latest newsletter deals with the possibility of a biological attack on America. And initially I thought they were just trying to frighten us to death and keep idle minds busy. But as I contemplate what I know about the AIDS epidemic, and I know a fair amount about it because I was in the battle for a decade or more, until I realized that AIDS really is a matter of population control. And then I came to realize that, of course, this disease never existed before. And contrary to everything they try to convince you, why, of course, this is a new disease. In fact, there are a number of brand new diseases. And the question is, where did they come from? And why are they plaguing America today? And why did they stop making smallpox vaccine available 30 years ago? So we have a whole generation of people all throughout the world who have absolutely no immunity to smallpox. And why is it that the only countries that have enough smallpox vaccine for all of their citizens are the United States and Israel, and very, very limited supplies even in Great Britain today? There are lots of unanswered questions. Well, we won't answer all of them in our latest newsletter, but at least we'll raise questions for you, and we'll be answering at least what I think, what I fear may be true in subsequent newsletters. But if you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, and that's the January newsletter, which just went to press today, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you haven't had a newsletter before, we'll be glad to get it to you. If you have access to the Internet, you can go up on the Internet, and of course you can get our newsletters there, and you're welcome to copy them. You can pull down our programs live 3 hours a day, our many archive programs, and then of course links to our other programs on the American Freedom Network and the Genesis Network. So again, remember our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Remember our website, RadioLiberty.com. We'll be back again here in just a moment with William Federer, and as soon as he finishes the story of George Washington Carver, then we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Bill Federer, and of course his website is why don't you go ahead and give your website again?
Amerisearch.net.
Amerisearch.net.
AmeriSearch.net. Amerisearch.net.
All right, fine. And of course you can get the Daily Minute email minute from Bill. And then why don't you go ahead and finish the rest of this amazing story of this amazing man who started as a slave and certainly became one of the great leaders of the last century.
Well, the last 10 years of his life, he dedicated to endeavoring to heal people. And here's another letter he wrote September 30th, 1935, to Thomas O. Parrish of Topeka, Kansas. And he said, I now have before me 3,000 letters from suffering humanity. Besides the people who come to see me every day and night, I often have to refuse to see anyone until I can get a little rest. And he says, your letters are to me a great spiritual message, and I appreciate your prayers much more than I have words to express. And and ask your congregation to please remember me in their silent prayers, that God may continue to manifest through me his glory, majesty, and power. And then he gives a bunch of scriptures, 2 Corinthians 3, 5, and 6, and so on and so forth. And then here's, just to show you what a spiritual man he was, he said in a letter, 1940, just 3 years before he died, to Reverend Haygood of Tuskegee, Alabama, he says, "I thank you also for your sermon at the Greenwood Baptist Church, and if we do not take Christ seriously in our everyday life, all is failure, because it is an everyday affair. If we can just understand that the golden rule way of living is the only correct method and the only Christ-like method, this will settle all of our difficulties that bother us." And, you know, just a tremendous person. Now, the and then here's another letter he wrote, 1938. He said, "Just received an invitation from General Clark of St. Paul, Minnesota, wanting me to come and speak." He says, he said that they would have absolutely no trouble in filling the auditorium, which holds 2,100 people. "The occasion of the meeting is a very spiritual group that is arranging a series of lectures on bringing Christ into our lives during the week before Easter. Yours very truly is George W. Carver." And now, here we have a man who started life as his dad died, his mom kidnapped, he was traded for a horse, he was lying, you know, in a blanket dying of whooping cough, an orphan, and ends it by starting a $500 million peanut industry. He was turning down job offers from Henry Ford and Thomas Edison. Ford realized or found out that Carver could extract rubber from milkweed, and Ford was looking for a new source of rubber for his automobiles. And he was visited there, and Thomas Edison, who invented the light bulb and the phonograph, he said, "Come to Menlo Park to my laboratories, and you can have all the equipment that you want, you know, the state of the art." And Carver turned him down. He would even save his paychecks, and when he died, they found a drawer full of thousands of dollars worth of his paychecks that he never cashed. He lived so simply. He was visited by Calvin Coolidge and FDR. He had two postage stamps with his image on them, one 50-cent piece coin. His birthplace was the first birthplace made into a national memorial other than United States president. And FDR declared the day of his death George Washington Carver Day. And then in 1966, the United States Navy dedicated a nuclear submarine, USS George Washington Carver, with the motto, "Strength Through Knowledge." And to think that the great accomplishments and how he touched the world in his own humble way is an encouragement to us that, you know, certainly if he did what he did without welfare or without affirmative action or without public school system, without all those, you know, helps, he did it all just through trusting the Lord and pushing ahead. We need to not have any excuses. We don't have any excuse why we can't let the Lord use us in just as great of a way. Carver was a pure man as far as, you know, his heart. He didn't harbor, you know, unforgiveness. One place he said, "Thank God I love humanity. Complexion means nothing to me." And when I was down in Birmingham, Alabama, a few years back speaking, and on Carver, a lady came up, and she had a full-page picture from the Birmingham newspaper of her at Tuskegee. And I said, "What's this?" And she said, "Well," and she was white, she said, "my dad went to Georgia, University of Georgia, and wrote his master's thesis on how the boll weevil destroyed the cotton crop in the South. And he also made mention of how some of the black sharecroppers were treated very poorly by the white farmers. And because of that, the University of Georgia wouldn't give him his master's degree." Well, Carver hears about it and calls this guy, his name was McCraney, to Tuskegee and throws a dinner in his honor and toasts him and then intercedes for him to go to Harvard Law School, and writing letters, and he gets accepted into Harvard Law School on a scholarship because of Carver's letters. He gets out and becomes a judge in Leeds, Alabama, and, you know, very wealthy and well-to-do, and he dies, and his daughter, who had been an unbeliever, you know, she was rebellious through a lot of her life. She came to the Lord and got became a Christian, and then when her parents died, she inherited this land, and she sold a piece of the property, and she felt like she never repaid Carver for the generosity to her father. So she gave a $10,000 check to Tuskegee Institute in her father's name, and her name was Susan McCraney. And in the article, it quotes the president of Tuskegee, and he says, "This is so much like Carver that race meant so little to him that he had no problem writing a letter on behalf of a white student to get a scholarship to Harvard, that he helped people of all races." And, you know, just a tremendous example for us in the 21st century that we're living in today.
Well, wouldn't it be wonderful if everyone was colorblind and we looked upon a man by the content of the character, not by the color of their skin? That was actually for Martin Luther King, but is one of the something that was really a truism. I dream of the day when a man will be known not by the color of his skin, but by the content of his character. And beautiful, beautifully said.
Yes. Well, I encourage people to get this book, and you know, it's a great gift for students, for young people, because they can see somebody that started off with nothing and did great things. It's a great gift for prisoners. I've been in prisons and in jails and have spoken, and I was at one prison out in Walsenburg, Colorado, and talked about how those walls may be intended to keep them inside as prisoners, but I said these walls cannot keep out the thoughts and can't keep out the Spirit of God, and God can give you thoughts and imaginations and inspiration like he gave Carver of things to create that can benefit mankind. And but they were all asking for copies of this book, and of course I don't have the finances to give them out. I'm just sort of a one-man show, but if people can buy the books from you, Stan, and Radio Liberty, and then give these books to the chaplains in the different prisons and have them put them in the libraries there in the chaplains' offices, and you know, donate the books to the high schools and the, you know, the grade schools, and then just to give them out to young men and women in churches, and especially in inner cities. I think it would be so wonderful for people to buy a whole case of them and to go down into the inner cities and to pass them out to the young, you know, 12 to, you know, 18-year-old minority children, and let put a vision before them that they can do anything, and that, you know, with a lot of work and no laziness, like Carver said, and like Booker T. Washington, you know, he worked all the days of his life, and Booker T. wrote the letter to Carver saying, "I ask you to give up money, position, and fame, and in their place I offer you work, hard work." So, you know, the answer is a lot of hard work, but trust in the Lord to draw aside the curtain, as Carver said. He said, "Without the Lord to draw aside the curtain, I would be helpless." And, you know, when he worked on needs, when he worked on projects which fulfilled a real human need. So he wasn't selfish trying to see how he could, you know, build the pyramid scheme. You know, he was working on trying to meet a real human need, and that's when he said those forces that worked through him were amazing. So I encourage those that are listening, you know, don't just listen. I want to thank you for listening, but get a copy of this book and get two or three copies, or even pitch in and get a case and distribute them and give them out, you know, to politicians, to people in all walks of life, because I feel like Carver's life is, at this period of time in our nation's history, is a key to bringing racial healing, as well as being an inspiration in times of trials and crises. His was the trial of the boll weevil, and then, you know, maybe being slandered in the newspapers. But we've got crises today, and you know, from the AIDS and from these diseases that you were talking about, Dr. Stan. And the answers come through prayer, but they come through people and that yield themselves to be used by the Lord. And I just want to, again, encourage those that are listening to buy a copy of this book from Radio Liberty.
Well, you know, I think really it's so interesting. You talk about the prisoners. You know, and we talk about people have to be have their lives in a position of crisis before, many of them, before they'll want to look for the Lord sometimes. It will just come out of no place, but often it's a crisis situation. And believe me, the men who are in prison are in crisis. And, of course, how easy it is then to approach them with the lie that the Muslim faith is the faith of the black man, and, of course, the white man is the devil, and, of course, to turn race against race. And, of course, this is all being financed by the Saudi Arabians, who are spending literally billions of dollars sending the clerics into the schools with the full support of the people within our government who are protecting the Saudis and allowing them to build. They've built literally several thousand mosques across America. But it is the radical Islamic clerics who are sending into the prisons where they are actually recruiting people into this. Really, this is a very violent religion that they're being brought into. And we need to be there to counter that. And this story you've written, really, it's a heartwarming story. It touches you, and you can't really read that book without it having a profound, profound impact on you. It certainly had an impact on me. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, now our telephone number, 464-8295. Here in the Central Coast of California, that's 464-8295, or out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest this evening is William Federer, and of course he is an author and a lecturer, and perhaps soon to be entering the political fray again. And if he does, why, he's going to need every bit of help that you can give for him.
Yes.
We need people of this category, you know, in the you know, representing the American people, not just from the people of St. Louis, but the people of the entire nation in Washington, D.C. I think Congressman Ron Paul needs a little help in there.
Yes, and I mean, we're losing J.C. Watts and Dick Armey and a lot of great people that I know. Gebhardt, I think we ran against him so hard the last couple times that he decided not to run for re-election, so his seat is open. And everyone I've talked to said that, you know, we've got the best name recognition from all the people that contributed prior. And so I was just in Washington, D.C. last week and talked with a lot of the people in the you know, in the political circles that could make it happen, and there's a lot of excitement there. So,
well, I'm excited too, and I'm excited for you. And I will be able to, will be, of course, in touch with you. And we do have some outlets there. I think we have 17 stations, and a lot of them are there in the Missouri area. So we'll be getting you onto that weekend program. It's not much, but at least it's a voice, and every person who can hear you and get to know who you are, at least is a potential supporter for your candidacy, which really is not necessarily for just the people there. But we need statesmen in Washington, D.C., not politicians.
Amen. I agree.
Well, and now, of course, for our listeners out there, I think one of the most important books in my library is America's God and Country. You want to talk a little bit about that? Is there anything else you'd like to talk about? Or should we talk about America's God and Country? This 850-page book, really giving the quotations from our founding fathers.
Well, I did want to emphasize one last time about
okay.
the Islamic faith, and I talked with a chaplain just last week who said that he goes into prisons and tries to, you know, pass out gospel literature, and the response he gets is either no, that's the white man's religion, or he said it's out and out hostility, that they become hostile, almost violent, when he tries to pass them Christian literature. And again, they blame the white system for them being in jail, and the Islamic black Muslim faith says the white man is Satan. And so that's definitely not the spirit of the Lord to bring that type of division. And I think that this is something that we need to address and do something about, or we're going to have a problem growing under our feet that our children will inherit, and it could be, right now as we speak, the Christians in southern Sudan are systematically being killed by the Muslims in North Sudan, and hospitals being destroyed that have been built by missionaries to take care of, the black Christians there. Slavery is still going on in Africa. The Muslims in the different countries capture the white children, the Christian children, and sell them. And there are ministry organizations that buy the children their freedom. And they say, like, $175, you can buy a little girl. And, of course, once you buy her, then you give her her freedom. But the slavery is still going on today, and it's the Muslims that are perpetrating it in northern, these different areas of Africa. It's a very serious situation, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the Carver book, is because he's a person that can bring healing. Another thought is, for years, Black History Month comes and goes, and most of the conservative people ignore it because it's been hijacked by Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson and that whole agenda. And I thought, well, why ignore it? Let's concentrate on highlighting black men and women who are conservatives. And, again, Carver's the epitome of someone who, started with nothing, without the help of the government, without the Big Brother government helping him. He ended up creating a $500 million peanut industry, and thousands and thousands, probably millions of jobs were created because of that. But that's one encouragement I have on the George Washington Carver book. And the other book is America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations. It's an 845-page reference book of quotes. You always wondered where God's in our history, and where do you go to get that? Well, you go to the public library, you're not going to find any old books. How do I know? Because I've been to the public libraries, and they've pretty well been emptied of any quotes that talk about our godly past. But I went to major university libraries, and the major universities, they'll have an old book or an antique book section in the back. Sometimes it's even thermostat-controlled, where the humidity and the controlled rooms, and I've read these old books, that were printed in the 1700s and 1800s, and the Blue Laws from Massachusetts. Massachusetts was the first colony, and the book of their laws, they actually put scripture verses after every one of their laws. They'll write a law that says don't kill, and then they'll put Exodus, such and such. And all the messages and papers of the presidents, where every president acknowledged God in their inaugural address, and all 50 state constitutions, and every one of them mentions God usually in the preamble. These are all references from our American history to God and to our Christian faith, and it's a resource to help people who are students that are writing papers in school, people that are politicians and they want to open a meeting with prayer, but they're afraid of the ACLU, and so what they can do is they can read a prayer from George Washington from the Library of Congress, and it's not you praying, it's you're reading a quote from the first president of the United States, but in 1795, George Washington issued a day of thanksgiving and prayer to Almighty God. Lincoln, during the Civil War, 1863, declared a national day of humiliation, fasting, and prayer. So if you don't want to, you're afraid in your speech or your public area where you're at, you're afraid that you'd get in trouble if you mentioned prayer, well, you can quote from Abraham Lincoln and from the the public papers of the presidents, which are housed in the Library of Congress. He gave a declaration of fasting and prayer. And we have forgotten God. We have forgotten the gracious hand that preserved us in peace, multiplied, enriched, and strengthened us. and we have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom of our own. He said, intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too proud to pray to the God that made us. It behooves us then to humble ourselves before the offended power, confess our national sins, and to pray for clemency and forgiveness. And that's not me talking, that's the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln. And so you can read those quotes in schools and in workplaces. The idea is, let history say what you can't. And if you feel prohibited in mentioning your faith, you can quote from one of these men or women in our history and let them be the ones speaking. You know, I was talking one place, I said, who's going to tell you that you can't quote in school the inaugural address of John F. Kennedy, where he said, the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God? Or who's going to tell you you can't quote from the inaugural address of Democrat President Harry S. Truman in 1949, where he said, we believe all men are created equal because they are created in the image of God. So let history say what you can't. If you can't mention God, you can quote from the presidents. You can quote from the state constitutions. You can quote from these different court cases. And so I put together the book, America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations, again, 845 pages, and it's also on CD-ROM, a word-searchable database, and these are all available through Radio Liberty.
Well, I appreciate so much the opportunity of helping you get these things out, and there is a conspiracy against God, and we have to counter that with the truth. And that is the fact that America had a godly heritage, and as William Penn had said so well, those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants, and that's what it's really all about. And those who would take away the religious foundations of this nation will replace it with the iron boot of tyranny. And it will happen not because they were smarter or better than we are, but because the good people did nothing. Well, we're just about out of time, Bill. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
I remember something David Barton said a long time ago. He said, a conspiracy is nothing more than a minority wanting to control a majority.
Right.
And they have to do it in secret because they're a minority and the majority would stop them. And so it's not anything any more hard to understand than just a small group of people that want to get the power. But it's up to us in the majority to speak up, to be vocal, and to know our history, and to know black history and Christian history, so that we cannot be pushed around. And these resources have been written, but it's up to you, the listener, to purchase them and get them into the hands of your children and those that can use them.
Well, we're out of time, Bill. God bless you. Thank you so much for being with me. Give my best to your wife, and tell her I appreciate her kind words.
Well, thank you, Stan, and God bless Barbara, and God bless all the listeners.
God bless. Good night. All right, that was Bill Federer. I hope that you enjoyed the program, and, well, until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
Program this afternoon.
Yeah.
And Barbara answered and she says, you're coming up tonight, right? I said, oh my God, I totally forgot. I worked 4 hours this morning. It's like I wasn't thinking and I didn't write it down.
Well, I tell you what, it's so easy to do, you know. I said, here she is.
Kind of quiet, but I'm glad you were here. For great that
okay.
Just a call about the problems.
Good night.
Good night.
Night.
Well, did you hear Bill said this? Take it back.